Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's episode is brought to you in association with Perkbox. Anyone who's come within an inch of Perkbox knows they take employee happiness very seriously. That's why they're organising the first ever Perkbox Workplace Culture Awards, a nationwide competition celebrating the businesses that go over and above to make people happy. It doesn't matter if you're a startup with a headcount of 10 or an established industry titan. As long as your business believes in putting people first, you could be in with a chance of winning a fabulous team party, courtesy of Perkbox. Go to awards.perkbox.com to nominate your company or another company of your choice. Nominations close on the 31st of October. The winners will be chosen by a public vote through November. Happy nominating. Hello, this is Bruce Daisley. This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. Has work been intense for you recently? Work has been deeply intense for me, and I've struggled to get new episodes done on the weekends because I've felt so spent. September, October is always hectic, and it's really done me in. So I'm human, sue me. Now, I have got about 10 episodes recorded, but my plan is to do something interesting with them, and it's such a colossal job, I've sort of been putting it off. Alongside work being hectic, I've had a lot of work travel, and then I did this TEDx talk in Newcastle, and I thought when I was planning it, I thought, should I do something brand new or should I do something familiar? You know, I've been doing presentations for my book, and there's probably a greatest hits of that I thought would be very easy. And I thought, I'm going to try something brand new. But I'll be honest with you, while I was doing it, I kind of lost my way early on because I'd been so busy, I didn't rehearse anywhere near as much as I should. I styled it out. I think you might not notice how bad it was as strongly as I did. I came off stage thinking, it's fine, I'll just never return to Newcastle ever again. Anyway, there were some lovely tweets about it, and I sold 50 copies of The Joy of Work at the Waterstones stand. So I suspect it probably wasn't quite the 1 out of 10 that I feared it was, but it was probably a passable 3 out of 10. And look, by the way, when I last looked, which was about 3 weeks ago, my book, The Joy of Work, was the second best-selling business hardback of the year. It was about 6 copies behind the number one book. So if you're planning to buy The Joy of Work, this could be your way to edge me to the top. No pressure, but it'll be your fault if I don't do it. Now, my month has been captivated by Johan Hari's book, Lost Connections. It's not brand new, but I stumbled upon it because I watched his new TED Talk, which is just, along with the book, is just wonderful and game-changing. It's nominally about depression, but actually, it's about modern life. My sister's just finished a master's in psychology, and she told me that everything he discusses is familiar, but I'd never seen it drawn together so holistically. Basically, he talks about if we replace the word depressed with disconnected, it might invite a different set of solutions. If you want to try before you buy, like I say, the TED Talk is beautiful, and it's his second TED Talk about depression, not the first one about addiction. I've linked to it in the notes if you sort of tap the bottom of your podcast app. Through both of them, he definitely appears to have rehearsed significantly more than me. Anyway, Johan told me in the summer that he was going to come on here. So make sure you tweet tagging him and me saying how much you'd love to hear him on Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. What's stopping you from doing your best work ever? That's the question that workplace culture expert Aaron Dignan asks in workplaces he visits. Aaron has written a new book called Brave New Work, which is a practical guide to reinventing work culture and redesigning our jobs. he sort of takes you step by step through the actions you need to take. He came in to see me armed with lots of the little props, in this case, little playing cards that he uses during his interventions. I'm in quite a bombastic mood during the interview, as you'll quickly hear, which is, I'll be candid with you, it's a lot closer to the real me. I normally do quite a good job of making myself seem more thoughtful half the time here. You might find this real me a bit much. I know I did during the edit. You should ask people who sit near me. It's exhausting. Aaron's advice is very practical. If you want to deal with too many meetings, he explains an approach you should take. And because he's so experienced in running these workshops, it makes it for a really fascinating practical chat. Here's my discussion with author of Brave New Work, Aaron Dignan. I admit I've only read half of the book, but the bit sort of tingled my brain a lot. Let's take a step back. So you've written this book, Brave New Work. Let's take a step back for why you wrote it.
Sure.
Because it sounds firstly like how you wrote it sounds proof of what you're talking about. But why you wrote it, I think, is an interesting journey.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, it's very needed. I think we're trying to accelerate this transition. So the book kind of takes the premise that the way we work is outdated and isn't serving us very well, that it was kind of invented on a factory floor 100 plus years ago, and we live in a very different world today with different expectations and different challenges. So we need to change that. It scales well to sort of, to take a thesis that you can have people dwell in a bit, tell them a story about where work came from and where it's going and how, you know, what we're seeing on the front lines of some of this change work. It seemed like a really nice way to reach a lot of people. And my hope, I guess, was that it would accelerate the transition from very bureaucratic ways of working to alternatives.
Right. So this is one of the first things I scribbled down.
Yeah.
That you effectively said modern work is bureaucratic, right?
100%.
We've created... What are the stats you give for the amount of meetings we have a week? You give different stats than I've got. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we're talking about, you know, somewhere between 10 and 30 hours a week, depending on the industry. Well into half our week, I would say, for most people in corporate work.
And so I think the secret of a good book is that it makes you think that you've come across a good idea. And so I scribbled down, which is completely stolen from you. But if the challenge of modern work is we need to be heading towards creativity, we need to be sort of furnishing our inventive selves.
Sure.
And our solution that we've come across to try and do that is bureaucracy. Solving a creative need with bureaucracy seems like it might be a system failure.
Totally, it's a system failure. And I think that's one of the reasons that most change management, even change management that has nothing to do with new ways of working, fails, is that we are trying to fix the organization like it's a watch. And in fact, it's a complex system. It's a human system with all this richness and uncertainty.
And so your big thing is we need to change the operating system of companies. And it seems like you're saying every company needs its correct operating system. There's not one size fits all, right?
No, I think at a principles level, we're going to see broader agreement that things like autonomy and transparency and purpose and trust and those sorts of things are probably resonant across most people in most cultures. But then the manifestation of that into a meeting practice, a decision practice, a way of sharing, a way of being, that's going to be that'll be locally customized,
right?
Just the way good food can be of many different cultures, but you know it when you taste it.
And is this a book that you've basically run as exercises with teams? Because it felt very practical. It felt like we're going into the meeting section and here are the stimulus that you might run as exercises with your team.
The book is the output of a lot of trial and error. So we've spent all of the Ready's history, almost 4 years, and then the better part of several years before that, doing this work with teams, sometimes to great success, sometimes to, you know, quite frustrating failure.
Go on, talk us through both examples. So,
yeah.
So when's it gone well?
So when it typically goes well, I mean, one example is we worked with a factory, a manufacturing facility, where we could kind of put a ring around it and say, all right, this 500 people is going to work differently, and they want to, and they kind of show up.
Here we go. Go on. So tell us that. What were they making?
So they worked in pharmaceutical space, and some that were, you know, kind of regulated, and some that were more over-the-counter products. And the sense when we got there was one of kind of lack of engagement. There'd been a lot of layoffs. There was a lot of downward pressure. And so the team was eager for agility and for some humanity back in the work.
And this was factory workers, actual people making the pharmaceuticals.
Oh, yeah. No, our direct client was the leadership team that was on site.
Right. So they said to you, help us make what I guess reduce burnout, stop people feeling. Yeah. Do people feel burnout in
and
factories?
Up the productivity? Oh yeah,
do they?
Yeah, I mean, imagine, you know, a lot of the work is highly repetitive, a lot of the work right. is highly constrained, and there's a lot of scrutiny. There's, right. a, I mean, you know, that a lot of the ways of working that I'm sort of arguing against in the book came from the factory floor setting.
Yeah,
right?
because you give these. This diagnosis, actually, which is good to take a step back at it, which is the system X and system Y. Is that right?
Theory X, theory Y.
So theory X gave us is what?
Yeah, so this is Douglas McGregor's work from the 60s. So essentially, if you ask people about the nature of human beings and work, there were sort of two schools of thought. Theory X is that people generally can't be trusted, and they generally need to be motivated with carrots and sticks, and they generally want to avoid responsibility and learning, and they're sort of, you know, people are lazy, effectively, and that we need to kind of treat them as such. And theory Y, the alternative, is that people are motivated by, you know, autonomy and learning and want to seek some responsibility and can be creative if the conditions are right, and that kind of, you know, that people are generally worthy of trust and respect. And his take was, his argument was, and there's been quite a few data points to support this, that when you ask people about themselves, they will say, oh, well, I'm very much theory Y. You know, right. I want to do important work in my life, and I want to grow, and I want to take risks, and I'm, you know, I'm someone that identifies with those values. But then when you ask them about the people at their local grocery or their colleagues down the hall that are in a different division or whatever, then those people are more theory X, right? And it's almost the Lake Wobegon effect of, like, everyone's above average. It's just not possible that each of us thinks we're Y, but everyone else is X.
So back to your factory.
Yeah.
That, you know, despite everything, I suspect a degree of theory X was meaning that they felt burnt out under pressure, scrutiny.
Totally, yeah.
So the go sense on. What were the stages of reaching a diagnosis, and then what intervention did you make?
Yeah. Well, one thing that's interesting is we try not to do a lot of diagnosis to anyone.
Okay.
We find that you know, in complexity, the people living the experience are closer to the truth than we are.
Right.
And I find averages very dangerous.
And this is your company. When you say we, it's your company.
Yeah, the Ready. So we do this work that sort of supports the Brave New Workbook. And so, you know, I think it's dangerous to play in averages, and it's very common for groups like mine to come in and assess and then make a report that says your number one problem is lack of trust. But I always joke that, you know, if Bezos walks into a bar, then the average net worth in the bar is $100 million. But that's not what's really going on. Mm. So I don't like those averages or those assessments. So instead, we really just go to teams and we start with the question of what's stopping you from doing the best work of your life, which is a heady question. But the funny thing is, every team I've ever met has an answer. You know, it's we have meetings to prepare for meetings, or we're not trusted, or we don't have the information we need, or, you know, and then we just start right there. We start with what's present and alive for the team. So some of the teams there were interested in faster ways to make decisions. Some of the teams there were interested in fewer meetings. Some of the teams were interested in what might make things feel more engaged or make employees feel safer in their jobs going forward. I mean, there were a lot of different thoughts.
And what are normally the barriers then? Is it bureaucracy? If it is bureaucracy, if we've diagnosed that the systematic problem is bureaucracy, how do you start eliminating bureaucracy? So let's go back to the factory.
Yeah.
So the factory people said, we want to do our best work. They gave you some ideas. Can you remember what specifics they were in the factory?
Yeah, I think that one was often a lot about agility, about making decisions quickly, about who had the right to make decisions.
Right.
So a lot of confusion. And when there's confusion in bureaucracy, we look up.
Yeah.
So if we don't know who has the right to do what, if we don't know where those edges are, then everybody looks up. And what's funny is everybody looks up until we end up at the top. And so then things are quite slow. And often uninformed, because the person that's running that facility doesn't know every nook and cranny of what's going on, nor can they. So that was one of the most common ones. And then just a sense that there wasn't a lot of, agency. People didn't feel like they could do anything differently, that they could suggest alternatives, et cetera. So we kind of needed to work on that. So what we do is we just invite people to start doing small, safe-to-try local experiments to see if it helps. So we get
minimum
one
viable product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's MVP for sure.
Right.
And I often refer to it as minimum viable policy. So what's the least amount of policy and structure we can have that protects us from chaos but doesn't limit and inhibit our creativity and our judgment? So you have teams, you know, there were 500 people there. There would be a dozen or more teams trying things. and we had a high transparency about what we're trying and what's happening. So everybody's hearing at town halls, at, you know, it, through channels, through things like Slack or social media, what is happening and how it's going. And then as things worked for teams, then others were invited to share in that and spread that. So we would actually have an organic spreading of practice. So maybe one team figures out how to make a decision differently or how to have a meeting that they really get a lot of value out of or what have you. And then they would say, well, here, if another team's curious about that, we'll codify it for them and we'll share it. Not mandated, but offered.
Okay, so it's almost like virality of popular initiatives spread themselves.
Yeah, because in theory, I mean, there's some first principles stuff that goes on here. So if all the ways of working come from the top and are mandated and are compliance-based, then when things change, the only person that can fix the system is the top. And so you get into this problem of time gap and of context awareness and all the things that are broken in a big, complex system. But if we teach teams to update their way of working themselves and they build that muscle of what are my tensions, what are my options, what can I experiment, well, how does it feel now, and they learn how to do that really well, then in theory there's no future stressor that they're not resilient to. Because the world will turn again. We'll get the meeting rhythm just right or the communication just right or the tools just right, and then the world's going to turn and it's going to be different and something's going to need to shift. So we want that capacity. So
let's stage an imaginary intervention.
Yeah.
So like, there's a whole section that I was going through on meetings.
Yeah.
And meetings are the curse of modern work.
They are.
They're like, you know, if you were going to put all the ills of work down on one thing, I think you'd probably land on meetings.
Because they're the microcosm of the culture as a whole.
Right, so let's go through a specific. You go into an organisation, they say to you, people in interviews or in group sessions, they say, spending too much time on meetings. Take me through the stages of what you would do and how you would help them reach resolution.
So one example, we worked with a leadership team that had 45 hours a week of meetings on average.
Get out of here.
I'm not kidding at all. This is a massive $100 million kind of company. So
that's literally they're in meetings from 9 till 6 every day, no lunch break.
Correct. They ate in meetings. I watched it.
Okay.
And when you have that much going on, the incremental approach of let's add another meeting or let's make one better didn't feel like the right play. So the discussion we had was, what if we stopped for 2 weeks and just saw what we missed? So we call it start by stopping sometimes. So instead of replacing the bad travel policy with a better one, what if you just get rid of it and see what emerges in the culture?
Okay.
So this was, let's get rid of the meetings and see what we miss. So what we missed was, at first, was we need a way to coordinate week to week on what we're doing. So we just need a way to like unblock the work, get a sense of what we're doing in this sprint, you know, this week or 2 weeks of work. And that's the most urgent need. So we started with that. So we rebuilt that. And one of our rules is that when we reintroduce meetings, every meeting has a facilitator. Every meeting has a scribe. It's elected from the group, just to kind of give the meeting structure. And the structure might be very, almost no structure, but there has to be an intent. Like, we're in this meeting to coordinate, or we're in this meeting to make decisions, or we're in this meeting to, you know, brainstorm or whatever it is. And then there should be a structure that supports that. So the facilitator can hold us to that structure and kind of keep us from victimizing ourselves. So we get those two roles in place, and then we introduce this approach to that meeting. And because we're students of this stuff and we look at all these hundreds of companies around the world, when someone says we need a weekly meeting to coordinate the work, we're like, cool, well, here's three versions of that meeting that we see working really well in different pockets around the world. And which of these seems like it's going to be the right starting place for you? Or do you have your own idea? So the client says, oh, you know, let's do that one. That format looks good. And so we introduce the format, run that meeting for a week or two. And at the end of every meeting, we always ask two questions. What did you notice and what can we do better? So what did you notice is, what happened in the room? What was the dynamic? Did somebody talk too much or not enough? Was there an energy shift? Did we feel plugged in, or were we all on our devices? There's no reaction other than just to say, what happened? Like, what are we present in our own way of working? And then the second piece is, what can we do better? So did this serve us or not? And we just build that muscle from the get-go then, so that from now on, when we finish a meeting, we're never going longer than a week without assessing as a group what happened here.
But tell me now, if you went back to that company now, the 45 hours a week, how many hours of meetings do they have a week now?
So when we finished rebuilding, I think they were in the 12 to 16 range.
Okay, so they're still at a normal range. Yeah. It's not like they've gone without.
They've since creeped up to, I think, north of 20.
Have they?
Yeah.
Okay, at least you're honest about that. It's like the patient often has some recidivism, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the reality is that this takes effort and it takes discipline, and it is, it's a practice. You know, even when you talk to the companies in the book that are considered way out ahead, when you actually sit down with them, they'll tell you, we're still learning, we're still figuring this out. As we scale, things are changing. Like, it is a breathing in and out that's always going on. The difference is most companies stop asking those questions and stop those experiments. And the ones that keep learning are the ones that's always an open, that's the second job that everybody holds, right?
What, as in going to meetings?
No, reinventing the way we work.
Right, okay, right?
I'm the VP of this, and I'm the VP of making sure that our way of working is serving us, you know?
What are the companies that either, once you've staged an intervention or before you went in, I saw you talking about Gore-Tex, but what are the companies that you think we can most learn from?
I mean, the ones I'm most excited about are, I mean, W.L. Gore is a very old one in the space that's quite watched and studied and I think underreported.
Give us like the study notes on W. Gore.
Yeah, so W.L. Gore is cool because one of the concepts they use internally there is called the waterline. And the idea with the waterline was we want to empower more decision making, but we want to be responsible about it because they make things like heart valves and, I mean, stuff that is real critical. So what they do is they say a waterline on a boat is if you get a hole below the waterline, the boat sinks. If you get a hole above the waterline, you can just patch it when you get back to shore. So that language becomes the guide for when you're about to make a decision, we trust you. If you think the decision's above the waterline, go for it. And you're going to be the judge of that. So do you think it's recoverable? Is it, you know, as Bezos talks about, is it reversible or irreversible? Is it going to, you know, is it going to really harm us as a team or as a company, or is it survivable? So if it's above the waterline, they say go for it. You know, use your judgment, do what you need to do. If you think it's below the waterline, seek advice from the people that have been there before, from the people that were going to be affected by your decision perhaps, and really hear that advice. And then if you want to keep going or do it the way you're going to do it, go ahead. But there will be, you know, there's consequences. There's reputational consequences, etc.
The one thing you've not mentioned, W.L. Gore, is it?
Yeah.
The one thing, there's no bosses and there's no reports at W.L. Gore, right?
That's
so,
right.
Like, so you're basically a loan agent and you're given the autonomy to make things done. But someone I know who went to work there said, it's actually effing exhausting. He said, you know, you're trying to build tribes. And when you're building tribes about getting Gore-Tex products into Nike items, there's plenty of people who want to help. When you're trying to get Gore-Tex products into something far more mundane, it's really difficult to build these. And he said, it takes you a while to acclimatize and it's just a sort of, it's exhausting experience, I think, from the uninitiated.
It's a reputational economy. And so Bill called it a lattice organization, so that it's quite networked. But what that means is when you're trading positional power, which has its own limitations, for reputational power, then when you're brand new in the system, you're kind of swimming and you're figuring out how to make those connections and how to motivate things and how to get things, you know, going. But if you've been there for a while and you have quite a bit of reputation, it's quite a bit easier.
Yeah, and so, I think the person I was chatting to was in the UK.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so
you
distance
can imagine
from the mothership
as well.
Yeah, so I think one of the things I'm very upfront about is every way of working has trade-offs. So you have to decide what are the trade-offs you want to optimize for. Mm. You know, what's the outcome that you're really looking to achieve? And in that case, in the case of a lot of the businesses that we follow here, they're very interested in prioritizing adaptivity. They work in categories where speed and change and that sort of thing is important, and innovation. And they're also very interested in prioritizing the human experience, the human centricity. And that doesn't mean that it's easy. You know, for us to do our greatest work doesn't always feel like a pleasure cruise. Sometimes it can ask a lot of us. And I think one of the metaphors I use in the book is the difference between a lighted intersection that's all about compliance and control, telling you when to go and when to stop, and a roundabout, which asks you to kind of use your judgment. And, you know, many people report that the roundabout feels worse to them because they feel like they're on notice. You know, they have to be really present in the system. They have to watch everybody else. They're coordinating socially. So it's harder to be in a roundabout than it is at a light where you can check your phone. But on almost every metric that we're aware of, the roundabout is superior, right? It's higher throughput, it's safer, it's cheaper to build and maintain, it's better when the power goes out. But it asks more of us. So I think there's a question of like the ask, the feeling of fulfillment and reward that comes on the other end, and also, you know, little aspects of personality type and fit and all those sorts of things.
More with Aaron after this. Today's episode is brought to you in association with the Perkbox Workplace Culture Awards, a nationwide competition celebrating the businesses that go over and above to make their people happy. As long as your business believes in putting people first, you could be in with a chance of winning a fabulous prize, courtesy of Perkbox. Go to awards.perkbox.com to nominate your company or another company you love. Nominations will close on the 31st of October. Winners chosen throughout November. Happy nominating.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now back to the chat with Aaron Dignan.
When you've gone in and helped a company, it sounds like as much as anything, you're guiding them to help themselves.
Totally.
To helping them to discover what works for them. What are the things that you've been most inspired by?
I think what's very inspiring is that 4 or 5 years ago, when I would have this conversation with leaders, there was a lot more resistance to the necessity, the possibility, the reality that the way we've been working might not be the answer. And I think what's very inspiring is now, almost no matter where I go and no matter what level I talk to, there's a sort of tacit acceptance that, like, yeah, bureaucracy and our inability to adapt has really caused some issues for us politically, environmentally, socially. There's an openness to the idea that there's got to be a better way, right? And so now I think that is quite enlivening. And when we get into teams and we see them with all their fatigue around change, because it's been done to them for so long, it's the PowerPoint over the weekend that the executive puts out and says, new organization, everything's going to be better now. But of course, we all know that that's often not the case. There's a cool thing that happens when the first team in a system who has been in that environment gets the opportunity to change some small thing about the way they work, see the result 2 weeks later, feel it, and then say, what's next? And something flips in people where they're like, holy shit. We just changed something that made our lives better, and now we're being asked to do the next thing, and like everything's possible, you know, even though it seems like a silly little change. Just the idea that like it was their change, and it happened, and now what's next?
And how radical do you think people are? So Cal Newport talks about maybe going to a world without email. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I chatted to someone last week at a firm that they don't have email,
right?
And a technology firm. And I said, oh, right, it must be Slack. And the person said, we don't use Slack. And I was like, right, now I'm interested.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And I was fascinated. I wanted them to talk to me, but they wouldn't because they saw it as their secret source. But have you seen any companies who are doing things as radical as that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, there are some companies in the book that almost take a no meetings stance. There are others that do them well, like, you know, Pixar really believes in their meetings because they're very bespoke and fit to purpose. Basecamp is sort of like, we want to avoid as many meetings as possible. If we could have none, that would be fine with us. So you see these different takes on, like, do it well versus don't do it. We don't use email internally, so we have kind of a hybrid approach at the ready where we say, no email internally. If you have to use it with external partners, that's the way of the world.
So Slack, right? You must be using Slack.
Yeah, we're big believers in Slack. It's not perfect, but the goal in a lot of our worlds is to have really good information symmetry and really clear pull methods of getting what you need. So,
right, so let's
knowing to go to the right channel.
Let's unpick what they mean. So information symmetry means?
Everybody has the same information.
Got it. And pull?
And pull versus push. So push is, oh, I have the information because I got it in an email from the boss, or I have the information because somebody, you know, shoved it in my drive or what have you. Pull is when I need something, there's a way for me to know where to go and to find it. So if I want to know what your team is doing next week, I can open Trello, go to your board, and see what your work in progress is. And I can see the status of anything.
Right.
Because there's no more politics and secrecy. And vice versa, you can see what I'm up to. That's sort of that pull method rather than the push method of like, you have to come to a review with me every week so I can hear your work status, you know, which is really more of a theater. It's a, it's a theater of my control.
So you're not really seeing like the results only work environment style, complete anarchistic autonomy. You're not really seeing a lot of that.
I think the polar take on this is that our choices are basically chaos or bureaucracy. And I find that in reality, when you really spend time with the companies doing this well, that seem to have a very human-centric way of working that's also very resilient, it's a nice in-between. You know, they found the things where it's that minimum viable policy. They found the places where structure is helpful. They have it. It's an agreed-upon structure, so it's consented to, it's governable, and it's updatable. And then where judgment is enough, where the two rules inside the roundabout of go with the flow of traffic and give the right-of-way to the people in the circle, when that's enough, then that's enough.
Do you think teams and companies are too big?
Yes. I think two things are true. So one, generally speaking, I think companies will get smaller in the future just by virtue of the power that we're going to be afforded with AI and robotics and other technologies. And the second thing is that there's a difference between a big functionalized organization and a big federalized organization.
Right, hello, what's this?
And so if you think about most traditional large organizations, as they grow, they notice that they have lots of little microcosms of sales organizations and legal organizations and P&Ls. And in an effort to create efficiency and scale and control, they often consolidate that into single functions. So you have global HR, global sales, global finance, global marketing. And what happens there is you get to maybe get rid of a little bit of the fat, and then you get one leader who's that big leader over it, and they can control, and then we have all this consistency. Our sales is so consistent. The problem, of course, is that this creates these silos that are self-reinforcing, that are self-scaling, that are self-policing, and these, you know, bulkhead walls between the functions so that if we ever want to make something that the user actually needs, we have to coordinate so much. And what you find in the organizations that we studied for the book is that they flipped that on its head and said, we can be as big as we want, but we want the unit of work to be small enough that it's manageable. So usually less than 150 people, sometimes way less. So Bertzorg, for example, is 14,000 people made up of 10 to 12 person nursing community squads. It's the whole company. It's just squad.
That's the Dutch nursing
homes. Exactly. And so they, what's nice about that is the scale becomes a non-issue. Right, there is scale, but really the unit of work that's happening is much more manageable. Same thing for Gore. I mean, Gore used to do a new building when they reached 150 people. So they would say, once we get to 150, we're going to open another building on the campus because we don't want more people than that in a space.
So let's look at what that would look like. So that means, back to your original example, that HR actually might have consistent policies, but there's not global head of HR. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that, you know, two things are true. One, a lot of what happens in a centralized HR organization could be happening at the edge. So it's pushing some responsibility back to the teams and saying, you know what? You're best suited to do your own recruiting. You're best suited to do your own hiring. You're best suited to do your own onboarding. That's your job as a team. When it comes to things that should be central, data, helping us know what fair pay looks like in a market, legal regulation, et cetera, that's a service. But it can be a much smaller service, especially in this technology future. Yeah. So now we have a 50-person HR organization instead of 500, and they're producing product for their users, which are these teams at the edge. So it's just it's a marketplace relationship rather than a centrally driven one.
It really reminds me of Nucor, Nucor are like the most profitable steel manufacturers in the US.
Yes, yes, yes.
But they... Every function is done remotely at each plant. So they've got marketing at that plant or HR at that plant.
And it's mini factories.
That's right. And you know, they believe that all the economies of scale are somewhat illusory.
Correct.
Because the economies of scale of having a global team is lost by that global team needing to travel around the world, have global
all
meetings.
All the bottlenecks and limits.
That's right,
and
it's sort of like this illusion. It's a bit like open plan offices. Open plan offices are a complete illusion that they look better.
Oh, we're so collaborative.
Paper. Yeah, that's right.
It's like, but
it
really.
Just leads to a spawning of emails.
Yeah, and I think that's right, is that we, because we know how to measure something like how many lawyers we have, and we don't know how to measure something like how quickly and effectively our legal operation is actually pushing things through, it's much easier to just be like, oh, well, if we put them all together, we can have 50 instead of 100, and wouldn't that be so efficient? But like you're saying, the efficiency really only matters when we look at the outcome. So at the, if the end of the day is that we're slower and we're more inhibited, then I'm thrilled that we're paying less for legal, but it doesn't matter. I mean, we'll essentially be efficient to the point of our own demise.
I think the reason why I didn't finish the book, and I've been busy, I'm not going to apologise, but because it feels so practical that I felt like it was like a great thing for someone preparing for an offsite,
right?
And we're about, let's tackle this theme,
yeah,
and
you
go
right
immediately
in
to the information chapter,
right?
And you
right
say, okay, what we're going to tackle on this offsite is how we use
that
information.
Yeah,
and we're going to use this to work through. Is that sort of the intention, or is it?
So, I mean, we use the 12 sections in the book as foils for asking yourself the question, right?
Yeah.
Just to say, like, this is where it's most, where work is most in flux. So if you're wondering kind of where to be looking, these are places to look. I think sometimes it's too myopic to just look at one thing.
Yeah.
But it's okay to look at one thing and say, all right, this is where we want to focus. And just to be aware of what else does that connect to. So information is a good example where often someone listens to a podcast like this and they're like, damn, I'm so excited about empowerment. I'm going to go empower my team on Monday. They forget that they have really bad information symmetry. Mm. So they have bad information flow. People don't have the information that the boss has. And then people make bad decisions with their new empowerment, their new autonomy. And then they say, oh, empowerment doesn't work. It's like, no, it works just fine, but it's connected to information. So you have to make sure that that flow is high, that people know how we're doing, the finances, the market, what other teams are up to. Then when they're making these empowered decisions, they're prepared. So we do it a little bit to sort of trace the lines there and say, what is this? What might inhibit this? What might enable this? And that's why, you know, we often start, we do this looping with the cards where we say, it is interesting what part of the OS we're playing in, but what's more interesting is just very granularly, what's the tension? What's the practice we're considering? How do we test it quickly in a way that's safe to try?
Yeah, yeah.
And if it happens to be information, great.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people want to do it in some blanket move where they're like, now our information game is perfect. That's not really how it works. It's a little bit more like gardening. You're going to trim this, adjust that, plant something new over there, you know, fertilize. Like, you're going to be interacting with it on an ongoing basis. So you want to be able to understand it systemically but operate locally.
Show me the cards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got to check these out. So I just want to see your reaction to these. So we'll start with tension. So there's 78. I tried to make
big
it
cards as well. These are like TV magician.
Yeah,
cards.
Exactly, right? Yeah, this is that. So there's 78 of these things, and these are the 78 most common bureaucratic tensions that we've seen in organizations across 15 countries.
So there's like a deck of cards with lack of trust is the top
number one.
It isn't always clear who has the authority to make decisions. And so what you would invite people to go through each of these
and just,
as a stimulus.
Yeah, and we would basically say, talk about this as a team and pick the five that are most alive for you right now. So it sort of gives us a foil to say, what's really going on here? What do we agree? Sometimes I'll have a leadership team break into two groups, two decks, come to the top five. And then what's hilarious is they're often not the same.
Too much consensus.
Mm.
People have to ask permission to take action. Opinions matter more than data. Okay. Tell me what happens. There's a tension because people reach different conclusions.
Yeah, so, I mean, what happens is a few things. A, sometimes it's nice to have the words. So often we're in cultures where maybe if I'm afraid if I say it and the boss hears me say it, there'll be repercussions. So the card says it for you. Like, everyone has to look at the card that says diversity is a problem here and decide, is that true or not true? And we sort of watch the room. And if we notice too fast a move, sometimes a boss will be like, our meetings are theater. Nah. And it'll be like, wait a second. Give that. Let that breathe for a second. And does anyone else see this? And just try to invite that bravery. So we get through there. We get the cards. If we get multiple teams doing it and they have different takes, then we can have the discussion that I brought up earlier, which is there's no such thing as one system here.
Yeah.
So you're both right. So these are all happening for you. So now what are we going to do about it? Instead of trying to agree on which one is the tension, which is nonsense, let's address the fact that we have
it's interesting.
Two different
and if culture is the way things get done around here, then this is trying to give name to aspects, these notes of culture.
Yeah, and the pockets of it that exist. Yeah. So the finance guy is like, our problem is no time for actual work. And the product guy is like, nuh-uh, it's meetings. Both are right. So now what, right? So we pick, we get those narrowed down, and then we bring out this practices deck. And this is really important because I find that the longer you've been working in traditional or somewhat traditional systems, the harder it is to think of alternatives because you've been modeling what you've seen and you know there's no time to think. So people say, alternatives, I don't know what my alternatives are. So we made this by going and talking to all these firms. These were the practices that progressive, you know, firms that were sort of prioritizing different things brought to the table. Some of them are quite obvious and some of them are quite weird. But now we say, take the five tensions you picked and match them with practices you think will move us forward, and importantly, practices that you yourselves as leaders are willing to try.
Right, okay.
Because otherwise, what's the point?
So some of these are craft a clear and compelling purpose for the organization. Okay. Ask teams to share their essential intent for the next 4 to 24 months. Clarify the metrics that matter and use them to steer. Recognize and celebrate noble failure. Okay, interesting. And so these are just things that you've observed in high-performing teams.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everything from, you know, really simple stuff like purpose to really challenging stuff around decision-making, around budgeting, around, I mean, you know, some of it's quite, some of them are quite exotic, some are very simple. But the idea is if you see a fit, if you see a connection between a problem that you have and a possible solution, now you have the makings of an experiment. So we say, you know, one of those said work in sprints to sort of break the work down and make it more manageable. And maybe your thing was we just get lost in these never-ending projects.
Okay.
So you say we get lost in never-ending projects. We're going to work in sprints. And we say, okay, great. Which team is willing to work in one-week sprints where we decide on Monday and ship on Friday publicly to everyone, wherever we're at, work in progress, for the next 8 weeks? And then at the end of that, how would we know if it worked? So what would be the learning metrics? How, you know, and what's funny is when I work with product people, they're often using a lot of these test and learn, lean startup techniques on the product. They're just not using it on the culture.
Right.
So it's like redirecting that energy to say, the way you're refining that product with the customer, you're the customer of the culture. So sort of turn that lens inward.
It's interesting. I was chatting to Seth Godin and I saw he blurbed your book. But Seth Godin said that quite often with culture, it's about building a little team that's doing things in a different way and waiting for people to notice.
Yeah, because I want what she's having.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And what we look for, so when we plant these experimental, you know, projects and we have teams doing this, it's never everybody. It's always a pocket, sometimes quite spread out. But what I watch for is I watch for organic practice spread. So if one team decides as an experiment they're going to start using a Kanban board and Trello or what have you, and that's their thing, and I walk past a conference room and I see another team using it, I'll pop my head in. Where'd you get that? What are you doing with it? Oh, well, we heard from the team over in product that they were having a lot of luck moving things forward and they have all this visibility and they like this tool, whatever the heck it is. And we say, that's it. That's actual change. Because now it's spreading organically, which means two things are true. A, we know it's actually serving us because we're choosing to adopt it. And B, we know we've started to create enough safety in our way of working that things can spread without permission. Because really the problem is many people know better ways, but they're not allowed. And so it's like, wow, the boldness to just change the way we hold this meeting because we want to, using something that another team discovered is really serving them well. That's the start of something quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. How do you think this sort of, the world of work and debate on these things is going to evolve?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we're at a crossroads right now culturally in the midst of, you know, Trumpism and Brexit and everything else, where we're really trying to decide, do we double down on the old way? Do we retreat into, you know, our tribes and our sort of traditions? Or do we really reinvent the way we solve these problems? Do we really step forward? And I don't know yet which is going to happen. I don't really count myself a huge optimist or pessimist. I count myself curious. But what I think is true is that the building blocks are there. The curiosity, the interest, and then also the infrastructure. I mean, one of the big problems is that the public markets have become metastasized and all they care about is volatility and short-term growth and never-ending growth. But then you have Eric Ries's long-term stock exchange coming online, and it's all about you have more votes the longer you hold a stock. So that's quite an interesting counterpoint. You have public benefit corporations and certified B Corps and cooperatives really coming up again in the States and over here as well. So there are new forms of organization that protect the purpose and the meaning a little bit more. And then, frankly, you just have these leaders that are like, you know, either fed up and ready to flip the table over or starting something new and are like, yeah, I'd really like to, from the ground up, get this right and put the pieces in place. So I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be one of quite binary polarities. You're going to have companies that are going way further into this change, and then you'll have others that are really doubling down. And yeah, I don't yet know exactly what to expect, but what I'm trying to do is encourage the bravery that's required to take the leap.
Thank you. That's been a fun discussion.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you very much.
That's my pleasure, totally.
Aaron's book, Brave New Work, is out now. I've given a link to it in the show notes. I've also posted his socials there so you can follow him. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all the lovely feedback about the most recent episodes, the episode with Pippa, some of the episodes before that. In fact, a lot of people have contacted me about that Marcus Buckingham episode, which was the one, The Nine Lies About Work. Now, I'll tell you, I really enjoyed that episode. I really enjoyed the discussion. I really enjoyed the take. A lot of people have taken exception to the thing that I pointed out about Chick-fil-A's culture and about Marcus working for Facebook. And I found myself going down a wormhole of reading various things on the internet. And one of them was I read the Glassdoor feedback. Do you ever read Glassdoor? It's sort of like the link, the review site, the Amazon reviews of working at different companies. I read the Glassdoor reviews for what it's like to work at the Marcus Buckingham Company. Wow. I would not be writing a workplace culture book if that was the review of my work. My goodness. I really appreciate you listening. Thanks so much. I'll speak to you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.